and welcome everyone to your world news. Let's go ahead and get started with the stories that matter. Senior officials of the United Nations have strongly condemned Israel's attack on the headquarters of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees in the occupied city of Al-Quds. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres slammed the raid, saying the site remains UN premises and it's inviolable and immune from interference.
In reaction to this event, I can tell you that the Secretary General strongly condemns the unauthorized entry into the United Nations Sheikh Jarrah compound held by UNRWA, located in occupied East Jerusalem by Israeli authorities. This compound remains United Nations premises and is inviolable and immune from any other form of interference. As a recently confirmed by the International Court of Justice, any executive, administrative, judicial, or legislative action against United Nations property and assets is prohibited by the Convention on Privileges and Immunities of the United Nations.
Dujarric added that the Secretary General has called on Israel to uphold the inviolability or UNRWA premises and refrain from taking any further action with regard to those premises. Reacting to the regime's raid, UNRWA's Commissioner General slammed the attack, describing it as a direct challenge to international law. In a social media post, Philippe Lazzarini said the raid came after months of harassment against the agency, including arson attacks in 2024, hateful demonstrations and intimidation, all supported by a large-scale disinformation campaign. He added that this campaign was accompanied by anti-UNRWA legislation passed by the Israeli Knesset, which he said further undermined the agency's ability to operate. On Monday morning, Israeli forces stormed UNRWA's compound, cut all communications, seized furniture, IT equipment, and other property, and confiscated the mobile phones of security guards. Journalist and political commentator Eric Wahlberg joined us earlier. He said UNRWA was targeted and sabotaged by the Israeli regime because of its good work in the Palestinian territories.
It's just continuing its march into the future of the greater Israel. It's violating all international law, and it gets away with it. So as long as it gets away with it, it's going to keep doing this. And UNRWA, because it was doing good work, it had to be sabotaged. So they sabotaged UNRWA right at the beginning. In 2023, they kicked UNRWA out and they started the starvation policy. And they're still only allowing in minimal trucks. And they get away with it. You know, I mean, if Trump was serious about his plan, he would not let them thumb their nose, their collective nose, Israeli nose, at the world. But he doesn't seem to care. It's clear now that this plan, this Trump plan, is just a fraud. It's just window dressing to give Israel more time to keep dispossessing, to go ahead with its annexation plan, and its slow killing of all Gazans.
Well, the Israeli regime presses ahead with its ceasefire violations in the Gaza Strip, killing and injuring more civilians across the war-torn territory. Gaza's hospitals received 5 bodies on Monday, including 3 new deaths and 2 bodies under the rubble. The fatalities included a woman who died in a drone attack in Jabalia in northern Gaza and another civilian killed in Israeli shelling of Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. The new casualties increased the number of civilians killed by Israeli forces since enforcement of the ceasefire to nearly 380. The dozen civilians were also injured in an Israeli drone attack on the tents of displaced people near the market of the Shujaiya neighborhood east of Gaza City. Casualties were also reported after Israeli warplanes bombed a house near a mosque in the Basra area of Deir al-Balah. Since October 2023, the Israeli genocide in Gaza has claimed the lives of nearly 70,370 civilians, leaving more than 171,000 others injured. Our Gaza correspondent, Motieba Mosabeh, joined us earlier with the latest updates on the Israeli regime's ongoing ceasefire violations across the war-torn territory.
Unfortunately, as you know, the people of Gaza Strip are still trapped in this endless and indefinite loop of misery and bloodshed under the weight of the relentless and incessant violations of the ceasefire agreement. We are talking about more attacks are still carried out against the Palestinian people in several parts of Gaza Strip. As you have just mentioned, that the last attack took place in Jabalia refugee camp after the Israeli occupation forces targeted the Palestinian people there with mass shooting and gunfire towards them. At least one Palestinian woman was confirmed killed, in addition to several injuries in the meantime. And previously, let me say that another Palestinian civilian was confirmed killed here in Deir el-Balah city after the Israeli fighter drones attacked a Palestinian residential building in the western side of Deir el-Balah city, Al-Bassa neighborhood. This area is supposed to be a safe zone for the Palestinian people under the understandings of the ceasefire deal, but unfortunately we're talking about more cruel attacks are still underway with no sign of abating against the Palestinian people, and more Palestinian civilians are still falling victim to those constant and growing attacks against the Palestinian people. In addition to that, the Israeli occupation forces continued their attacks against the eastern side of Khan Yunis city, which was under heavy bombings of the Israeli shells and the Israeli artillery strikes. So the current situation is very precarious on the ground for the Palestinian people, particularly for those who are still taking shelter near or in the areas adjacent to the so-called yellow demarcation line.
Well, a total of 6,000 people who have lost limbs in Gaza due to Israel's brutal war urgently need long-term rehabilitation. The Gaza Health Ministry says over 35% of them are children and women who need urgent treatment, warning that the lack of rehabilitation facilities and supportive equipment multiply their suffering. Ad Ibrahim has the details.
The human cost of the war in Gaza is etched not only in the lives lost, but in thousands living with irreversible physical trauma. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, 6,000 people have undergone amputation since the start of Israel's genocidal war, an explosion of suffering that has reshaped entire families and communities.
Before the war, there were around 1,500 cases, resulting also from Israeli attacks. Now, after the war, the number increased to be over 7,500. This is an indication of their continuous suffering. The prosthetics are not available, and the lack of rehabilitation make the task of this center more challenging.
The ministry reports that children make up one in every four amputees. Their lives are abruptly transformed before they even learn to dream freely. Women account for 12.5%, many having lost limbs while trying to protect their families or flee bombardments. Behind each number is a story of terror survived. Yet survival, doctors warn, is only the beginning. Gaza's shattered health system offers little for those who must now learn to live differently. Rehabilitation centers lie in ruins, prosthetics labs lack the most basic materials, and patients often leave operating rooms to a reality without therapy, mobility aids, or even adequate pain relief.
For Gaza's amputees, the struggle now is not only for survival, but for dignity, mobility, and the ability of rebuilding hope in a place where so much has been reduced to rubble. Ad Ibrahim, Deir el-Balah City, Palestine.
The Israeli regime presses ahead with its aggressive plans to seize more Palestinian land in the occupied West Bank. Now, the regime's far-right minister, Bezalel Smotrich, says more than $800 million will be allocated to the establishment of 17 new settlements over the next 5 years. According to Israeli sources, part of the money will go to building new settlements, while another part will be allocated to the settlements recently approved by the regime. The rest of the funds will go to nearly 40 settlements and outposts that are already in place. The funds cover basic infrastructure such as water, sewage, and electricity, along with public buildings like synagogues and community centers, all intended to consolidate settlers' presence across the West Bank. The regime will also build absorption clusters in the new settlements that will allow settler families to move in and create an initial core population. The plan includes the relocation of three military bases to Palestinian areas in northern West Bank, from which the Israeli army had previously withdrawn under the so-called Oslo Accords. Our West Bank correspondent Akat Hamad joined us earlier with the latest updates on new Israeli plans to seize more Palestinian land in the occupied territory. Let's take a listen.
2.7 billion shekels, which equals almost $1 billion, just allocated, were allocated to colonialism and settlement expansion. This very controversial decision is considered to be one of the most dangerous decisions that Bezalel Smotrich, the Minister of Monetary in the Israeli regime, has taken. And despite that, Bezalel Smotrich have worked extremely hard and put all of his efforts to annex the West Bank and to impose realities on the ground and to weaken the Palestinian Authority as much as he can. This decision is yet considered to be the most dangerous decision that has been taken, because this decision includes many details that are critical to the Palestinian land and to the Palestinian ownership towards the land. 17 settlements will be receiving fund directly, like Ma'alot Halhul, Hanur, and Har Aibal. All of these settlements are in new areas that has not included settlements before in the occupied West Bank. It was entire, it was geographically connected Palestinian lands, and now it has been cut off with new Israeli settlements.
Well, it's been 38 years since the first Palestinian intifada against the Israeli occupation and apartheid. And yet the regime keeps going with its agenda of destruction, raids, and brutalities across the occupied territories. Despite the Palestinian resistance, the situation on the ground today reflects the same patterns of oppression that ignited the uprising in 1987. Our correspondent Tiba Asi reports from the West Bank city of Jenin.
For many people around the world, the first Palestinian Intifada may be a moment of the past, but for the Palestinian people, it remains a movement advocating general, united, and comprehensive resistance to the occupier on their soil despite the constant terror created by the Israeli occupation. Over the past months, the West Bank has witnessed intensified military raids, home demolitions, siege of cities, and near daily assassinations and arrests. These events echo the same oppression that pushed Palestinians to rise up 37 years ago.
What's happening in Jenin is part of a wider Israeli plot to pressure and weaken the social and political structure of the refugee camp. The destruction and displacement are meant to change the reality on the ground, even if temporarily. But the resilience of the people shows what the community experienced during the first and second intifadas. In the end, the residents believe they will return, because the Jenin camp has always been a symbol of steadfastness.
Despite calculated attempts of the occupying regime to eliminate the Palestinian people through raids, land confiscation, and settlement expansion, Palestinians stand firm today.
We lived through the first and second intifadas, facing raids, demolitions, and tanks, but we always stood our ground. But this invasion has been the hardest. We were forced out of our homes and became displaced in our own land, leaving behind a camp where every corner holds memory. Still, we remain patient and steadfast. The Jenin camp isn't just a place for us. It is our life.
I am a refugee, and today, once again, I am displaced. I lived through raids, fear, and long sieges, and we always stayed strong. But being forced out of the camp this time is different. We left behind everything we built, and the place where we raised our children is no longer there.
It is not a conflict. It is the occupation of Palestine from an outside entity solely created by the West. Palestinians are being killed. Their homes are demolished and being displaced every day. What is happening in the West Bank today is part of a calculated effort to weaken, fragment, and erase the Palestinian people and their personnel, culture, and historical identity.
The first Palestinian Intifada, a defining moment 37 years ago, remains a powerful symbol of Palestinian resistance. And today, as Israeli escalation intensifies in Jenin, that same spirit continues to shape the people's determination to withstand the ongoing campaign of violence. Tiba Asi, Occupy Jenin.
While Israel continues to violate the ceasefire agreement with Lebanon as the regime carries out fresh acts of aggression against the Arab country. According to local sources, a series of Israeli airstrikes have targeted several areas in southern Lebanon, including Iqlim al-Tufah, Nabatiyeh, and Jabal Safi. Iqlim al-Tufah has been hit with at least 8 strikes. Israeli aircrafts have also attacked the Wadi Azza and several other areas. We were earlier joined by our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, who provided us with more details.
These are part of the continuous Israeli aggression on Lebanon, which, as many have been calling it, it is no longer a violation of the actual agreement, the ceasefire agreement. It is actually in itself a new wave of aggression and air raids. As you mentioned, we have more than 7 air raids in the area of Iqlim al-Tufah alone. That is in the surrounding of one of the large mountains there. And we also have several valleys that were targeted, the Zifta Valley, the Azza Valley. We also heard that there were, we learned from people, from inhabitants in that area, that several houses were damaged, there were broken windows and so on, but up until now there are no human casualties recorded. But of course this does go in line with the continuous Israeli policy. The Israeli media, the Israeli occupation forces have issued a statement saying that they have targeted an area which is an area of training, rehabilitation, also launching ground for the resistance, as they say. But of course, up until now, there has been no proof from any of these strikes that they have struck. And just recently, they struck one of the civilian houses in South Lebanon, saying that it is an area where Hezbollah has infrastructure. And of course, the people of that area have categorically denied those claims.
Well, thank you very much for this hour's headlines. More updates, as always, please stay tuned to World News. Bye for now.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Sistan and Balochistan is populated by over 9,000 villages. The village of Ghalanor dates back to the Qajar period, and since this area isn't prone to earthquakes, the adobe houses have managed to survive for about 150 years. Isn't that amazing? About 40 kilometers from the city of Zobol, this village was originally built on top of a hill and witnessed the migration of the villages of Old Fort. In fact, that's where it gets its name, Ghalanor, which means new fort. Ghalanor was built on high ground to protect its occupants from flood, since the varying amount of the flowing water of the Hamul River has always caused different problems for the people living in the Sistan Basin. But that's not the only thing the architects of this village had up their sleeves. During the Qajar period in the 18th and 19th centuries, different regions were managed by overlords or khans. The most eye-catching structure here is the two-story adobe castle of the Khan of the region. It was built at the entrance of the village and around a small hill, so the top of the hill is the floor of the second story. The village is currently being restored and is going to be turned into an ecotourism village. Kilometers from Galeno lies a mysterious and ancient city referred to over the past 200 to 300 years as Dahani Ghulaman, or Gateway of the Slaves. Dahani Ghulaman is the largest Achaemenian site in the entire eastern section of Iran that has been dated back to between the 4th and the 6th century BC. More importantly, it's the only Achaemenid site that may hold within its depths the secrets of the lifestyle of the ordinary people living at that time. Built in the wilderness, away from the imperial capital, even with the alignment of buildings roughly in a straight line, running southwest to northeast along the edge of water supplies, the site was only inhabited for a brief period of a century or a century and a half, and was abandoned as a result of natural forces that have always determined the survival and migration of urban settlements in the arid region of Sistan. The entire site was covered by sand. After it was dug up about 50 years ago in the 1960s, the layout of this ancient city was studied extensively by archaeologists from around the world. And it seems that they all came to a similar conclusion. The precise architecture and great harmony in the design of Dahani Ghulaman suggests that it was built with urban planning in mind about 2,500 years ago. Geometric studies on this site have revealed 27 major structures and an additional 23 buildings, most of which have not yet been unearthed. It was believed that the Achaemenids used architectural plans only in the construction of palaces and important buildings, such as the royal residences of Pasargadae, Persepolis, Susa, as well as Dasht-e Gohar. But it seems that the people of Dahani Ghulaman even prepared an architectural plan for the construction of their alleys and ordinary houses. The urban planning, the architecture, the temple, the location and size of what remains of this ancient city have led scholars to believe that it was a satrapal capital or something very similar to it in character. Studies into the origins of the hearths, fireplaces and altars have tried to reveal their purpose since they have a unique architecture. Were they used for animal sacrifices since animal blood was found on the altars? What kind of rituals were performed here? All these studies have tried to find answers to the many questions that arose 40 years ago with the unearthing of the site and have never been completely answered, even to this day. Standing atop the nearby hill that gives you an overview of the site, you can see lakes filled with a considerable amount of water around it.
The Chaimime reservoirs in the south of Zabul are three big lakes that are the second most important water storage reservoirs in the region. The water stored in these big lakes is used to irrigate the Sistan plain and to provide drinking water for the cities of Zabul and Zahedan.
Trees were planted all around the lakes by the University of Zabul to prevent dust from falling into the water. This is Golnar Farnoudi for Iran.
Behind this beautiful old wooden door lies an ancient civilization, a wealth of cultural, artistic, and religious jewels that portray the civilization of a nation.
The Qom Astana Museum, located in the city of Qom, right near the holy shrine of Fatima Masuma, sister of Imam Riza, opened up its doors to the public back in 1935. The museum has an area of 1,000 square meters with two floors hosting two exhibition halls. More than 1,000 artifacts and objects of artistic, cultural and historical value are displayed here. These treasures belong to different periods in history, from the 1st and 2nd millennium BC to the Islamic era in the country. The museum displays a wide range of objects and artifacts, varying from paintings, chinaware, ceramics and pottery, to priceless handmade rugs, glassware and precious Qurans.
Museum near to the shrine of Fatima Masura. It's wonderful to look around this museum, particularly to look at the carpet, beautiful carpet, and with the silk, beautifully designed. And also, I look around some of the places to look at the Quran, the oldest Quran from the 9th century to the present time. It's amazing to keep those kind of like traditional symbolic teachings of Prophet Muhammad.
The crown jewel of Iran's handicraft industry is its beautiful handmade rugs and carpets. Excavations in Iran have revealed that this art dates back to the 1st and 2nd millennium BC. The treasured silk rugs in this museum are valuable for their extraordinary designs, rich combination of colors, and excellent texture. One of the main features of Islamic architecture is the gorgeous glazed tiles that decorate the interior and exterior of the buildings. This art form reached new heights during the 14th century when the Timurid Empire ruled the country. The oldest tiles in this museum belong to the Seljuk era, some 12 centuries ago.
Where do you think beautiful doors opened up to? There must have been a beautiful heaven behind these doors that inspired the artist to create wonders on these beautiful creations.
The decorated doors displayed here date back to different time periods, but all adorned beautifully with different artistic techniques. Some are decorated with the art of marquetry, wood inlaying and wood carving with delicate pieces of ivory, bone, brass, gold and silver sections. Others are made with metal, embellished with inscriptions written by the best calligraphers of the time.
Size isn't really an issue when it comes to narrating history. Some items here in this museum are quite small in size, but great and precise narrators that reveal historical facts.
Museums are the spiritual and cultural treasures of a nation that clearly display the wisdom, intelligence, and artistic abilities of the past generations. These jewels are ever eternal. Hoda Lezgi for Iran.
I've trusted you a thousand times, but you always bring me back to the same place. My heart is moaning, but you can't hear. But do you care about me except my face? You think you know everything, you think you're enough, but sometimes a tiny virus ruins your life. You have so many heroes, but only in movies. I've tried all you said. Is there any way left to save me? I'm inside.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, mind your own flaws. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z here on Arab English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And you know, obviously, we, as Muslims, we need to be, we're told that we need to be so concerned with our own flaws, with our own character, really, that we're not even aware so much of what someone else is maybe doing wrong or what they've said wrong. That's just the general attitude. Obviously, that does not mean that if something really bad is happening or someone's saying something really bad that's having a bad impact on other people, that we don't sort of then become aware and maybe sort of take action, as in take the person aside and speak to them at some point about it. Now, this is just the idea that, yes, we need to focus on ourselves when it comes to purification. Now, this is something that one of the famous martyrs from the Holy Defense abided by. So the martyr is Ibrahim Hadi. And so he, in particular, did not like or abhorred actually backbiting. And actually, all of us need to abhor backbiting. And look, backbiting is very prevalent in our societies, whether it's a Muslim society or a non-Muslim society, whether we're living in a Muslim-majority country or not. whether we are Muslims or not, we somehow fall prey to this very horrible trait. And I just remind you, obviously, the punishment for backbiting is quite severe because it's considered not just a private sin, it's also a public sin. And Allah, in general, we're told that it's not going to be forgiven until we sort of make amends in a particular way, ideally through asking forgiveness of the person we spoke badly about. But obviously, I just want to mention one thing that Ibrahim Hadi would say. So he would say, so if he noticed that someone wanted to talk about someone else's flaw, he would say that no, we cannot, because we ourselves have at least 1,000 flaws. Welcome back to A to Z here on I Being Betrayed with me, Sister Zainab. And also I'm talking basically about backbiting and just minding our own flaws in general. So as I've mentioned, the martyr from Hall Defence, Ibrahim Hadi, who would say that, you know, we cannot pick up on the flaw of another person, given that we ourselves have 1,000 flaws. And we might, and this could be actually a useful task. Obviously, you know, during Qadr night in particular, we are support. One very nice task we do, or that we can do, is to, in a sense, ask forgiveness. And I remember so if you do this yourselves and literally write down all the sorts of things you did, you think you've done wrong, all your flaws, deeds or words, and we should not ourselves try to distinguish between these greater and minor sins and think, oh, but that wasn't so serious, I don't need to write that down. This is one of the big mistakes. We should never take even what we might regard as small sins lightly, because they're the ones that then might also lead us to greater sins. And that could also mean that we are a little bit arrogant in front of Allah, thinking that, well, you know, that sin, that flaw isn't so bad. You know, Allah will decide what punishment is due to us and whether we've actually repented properly for our sins. So maybe do this task. It doesn't have to be Qadr night. It could be any time. Because this just gives us an appreciation, like Ibrahim Hadi had, of how many flaws we have. And for sure, if many of us write down all the things we think we've done wrong, whether it's just in the last day or the last week, obviously we might surprise ourselves and might think, oh, there's so much that I've done. And, you know, and obviously I urge all of us, if we're aware of things that we've done wrong, said wrong, best thing is to ask forgiveness of Allah as soon as possible if we become aware that we haven't. So, inshallah, this is a real reminder for all of us, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on Arab English Radio. And farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Choose to think better. Welcome to A Better You. IRIB English Radio. visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
That was the week that was. Beyond the headlines, we dissect the stories that shaped the past 7 days, from the heart of region to the global stage. God, the compassionate, the merciful. Hello, dear listeners. Welcome to our political chat show, That Was the Week That Was. We look at global politics and issues of the day, and I'm your host, Leila Garcia. With me here in the studio is veteran journalist and political commentator, Miranda Akhshand. Please stay tuned. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks very much indeed.
Today's discussion is about a new survey which has found half of Europeans see Donald Trump as enemy of Europe. A new survey has found that nearly half of Europeans see Donald Trump as an enemy of Europe. Rather, more, the risk of war with Russia has high, and more than two-thirds believe their country would not be able to defend itself in the event of such a war. The nine-country poll from the Paris-based European Affairs Debt Platform, the Grand Continent, also found that nearly three-quarters of respondents wanted their country to stay in the EU, with almost as many saying leaving the Union had harmed the UK. Jean-Yves Dolmagen, a political science professor and founder of the polling agency Cluster 17, said Europe is not only facing growing risk, it is also undergoing a transformation of its historical, geopolitical, and political environment. The overall picture of the survey shows Europe that is anxious, that is deeply aware of its vulnerabilities, and that is struggling to project itself positively into the future. Okay, let's bring in veteran journalist and political commentator Miranda Akhshand.
Thanks for inviting me.
My first question is, the survey has also found a relative majority, 51%, felt the risk of open war with Russia in the coming years was high. Tell us more about that.
Yes, this survey was actually conducted in nine European countries, namely France, Italy, Spain, Germany, Poland, Portugal, Croatia, Belgium, and the Netherlands. And a majority, or a slight majority, about 51%, felt the risk of open war with Russia in the coming years was high, and 18% considered the risk of war with Russia as very high. So views varied strongly according to proximity to Russia. For example, 77% of respondents in Poland considered the risk of war with Russia to be high, and 54% of the French public considered the risk to be high, 51% in Germany, 39% of the public in Portugal thought the risk of war with Russia was high. Portugal is much further away than Poland, for example. And 34% in Italy felt that way.
Right.
The survey showed that the possibility of direct conflict on the European continent is now widely accepted by the European public.
But the survey also found that confidence in national military capabilities was low everywhere. Can you explain that for us?
Yes, confidence in national military capabilities was low. Mm-hmm. And the survey found with 69% of respondents across the nine European countries said they thought their country was not really or not at all capable of defending itself against Russia.
Right.
French respondents were the most confident, but it remained a minority opinion at 44%. Mm-hmm. In Poland, for example, which shares a border with Russia, 58% were not confident. And political science professor and founder of the polling agency, Jean-Yves Dormagen, said we're entering an age of danger while feeling a persistent sense of national weakness.
Right.
Feelings of vulnerability were widely shared, according to the survey, with only 12% of respondents saying they did not feel particularly threatened by a raft of sources of insecurity, ranging from technological and military insecurity to energy and to food.
Yeah. The vast majority of respondents across the 9 European countries in the survey backed EU membership. Tell us more about that.
Yes, you're right. The vast majority of those who replied in the 9 countries supported European Union membership. 74% of the European public said they wanted their country to remain in the European bloc.
Yeah.
With this sentiment being highest in Portugal, 90% of the public in Portugal said they wanted their country to remain within the European Union. In Spain, 89% of the public said they wanted Spain to remain in the European Union. The second lowest was in Poland with 68%, and the lowest was actually in France.
Right.
With 61% of the French public saying they wanted France to remain within the EU.
Mm-hmm. What did the survey say about Brexit, the UK's decision to leave the European Union?
Yes, well, that's another point in the survey. Britain's decision to leave the European Union is widely seen in Europe as a failure. 63% of the European public believe Brexit had actually had a negative impact on Britain, and only 19% thought it had been positive, and just 5% thought Brexit had been very positive.
Mm-hmm.
So the vast majority, 63% of the European public, thought Brexit, Britain's decision to leave the European Union, had a negative impact on Britain.
Right. Donald Trump has admitted that the path to peace in Ukraine is unclear. What is the latest on peace negotiation between U.S. and Russia and U.S. and Ukraine?
Donald Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, accompanied by Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, spent nearly 5 hours in talks with President Vladimir Putin at the Kremlin on Tuesday, 2nd of December.
Mm-hmm.
Moscow later said the meeting had not brought the sides any closer to a peace agreement. But Donald Trump on Wednesday, 3rd of December, described the discussions in Moscow as reasonably good, though he acknowledged that the path ahead for peace in Ukraine remained unclear.
Right.
Speaking to reporters in the Oval Office on Wednesday, 3rd of December, Trump said Putin would like to make a deal,
mm-hmm.
but what comes out of that meeting, I can't tell you because it takes two to tango.
I see.
And President Trump said the U.S. had something pretty well worked out with Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has ruled out giving up territory Ukraine currently holds. And on Wednesday, he said his team was preparing for meetings in the U.S., adding that dialogue with Trump's representatives would continue.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the latest on the peace efforts between U.S. and Russia and
right.
U.S. and Ukraine.
Yeah, I see. There's some anxiety and mistrust among European leaders over Washington's role in the peace negotiation with Russia. Tell us more about that.
Yes, this is a leaked transcript of a high-level call published by the German magazine Der Spiegel.
Mm-hmm.
And it has exposed deep anxiety among European leaders over Washington's role in the peace negotiations with Moscow. The call, held on Monday, 1st of December, included the French President Emmanuel Macron, Germany's Chancellor Friedrich Merz, NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte, and Finland's President Alexander Stubb,
right.
as well as Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine and various other leaders and politicians.
Mm-hmm.
According to the transcript, several participants voiced fears that the United States could abandon Ukraine at a critical moment.
Yeah.
For example, the French President Emmanuel Macron said, "There is a possibility that the United States will betray Ukraine on the issue of territory without providing clarity on security guarantees."
Mm-hmm.
And Macron warned of a great danger for Volodymyr Zelensky if Kiev were left exposed. Now, the German Chancellor Friedrich Merz urged Zelensky to be extremely careful in the coming days. Merz said, "They are playing games both with you and with us," he was apparently referring to Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner,
yeah.
whom Friedrich Merz said they were playing games with both mm-hmm. Zelensky and with the Europeans.
Right.
And Finland's president, Alexander Stubb, appeared to back Friedrich Merz's assessment. So the Finnish president, Alexander Stubb, said, "We cannot leave Ukraine and Volodymyr Zelensky alone with these guys."
Mm-hmm.
So with these guys, he meant Steve Witkoff, President Trump's special envoy, and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. He said, "We can't leave Ukraine and Volodymyr Zelensky alone with these guys." Presumably, I think he meant Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner.
Yeah. Right.
Now, on Wednesday, the European Commission announced it would move ahead with controversial plans to fund Ukraine with a loan based on Russia's frozen assets.
Mm-hmm.
This is completely illegal and goes against international laws and protocols. In a concession to concerns raised by Belgium, Belgium is the host of most of these Russian assets. The European Union executive has also proposed the option of an EU loan mm-hmm. based on common borrowing. EU leaders will be asked to decide on the options later this month as Ukraine faces a funding emergency now. Russia's Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev has unequivocally stated that if the European Commission's plan to fund Ukraine with Russia's frozen assets is in effect a declaration of war on Russia.
I see. Listening to the Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran, English Radio. This program entitled, That Was the Week That Was. Foreign policy chief Kaya Kallas has said the fierce talks between the Russian President Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff will pile pressure on Ukraine to make concessions. What is that about?
Yes, the European Union foreign policy chief Kaya Kallas, referring to Steve Witkoff, Vladimir Putin meeting, said, "I'm afraid that all the pressure will be put on Ukraine to make concessions and obligations."
Yeah.
Whereas in order to have peace, she said, we shouldn't lose focus that it was actually Russia who started this war. Mm-hmm. Now, European leaders have been alarmed by a U.S. plan, which they say is heavily tilted in Russia's favor, that emerged last month in November to end the war between Russia and Ukraine. The plan granted Moscow territories in eastern Ukraine it did not yet control, while forcing Kiev to cap the size of its army and abandon its ambition to join NATO.
Right.
The plan has since been changed, of course, but Ukraine's European allies remain concerned about any peace plan
mm-hmm.
that could enshrine the forced change of Ukraine's borders. So EU Foreign Policy Chief Kaya Kallas also said, the push to end the war in Ukraine could be entering a pivotal week,
mm-hmm.
warning that allowing Russia to change borders by force would set a dangerous precedent for the entire world. Now, earlier, Kallas described weekend talks in Florida, United States, between U.S. and Ukraine as difficult but productive.
Mm-hmm.
She was asked whether she trusted the United States to find a good solution for peace in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And Kallas said, Ukrainians are there alone, meaning they're alone in Florida.
Yeah.
If they would be together with the Europeans, they would definitely be much stronger. But I trust that Ukrainians can stand up for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is under pressure after the sudden resignation of his head of cabinet and one of his closest advisors, Andrei Yermak,
mm-hmm.
in response to a widening anti-corruption investigation that has become the most serious scandal in Volodymyr Zelensky's presidency. So Andrew Yermak has actually stepped down mm-hmm. now. He was one of the closest advisors to Zelensky. He was also the head of the cabinet. He has resigned from his position. And also a new study has shown that Russia has made the biggest advances in Ukraine in November of 2025. Just last month, the Russian army has captured 701 square kilometers of land, the second largest territorial advance in the war after November of 2024, according to a new analysis.
To sum up very briefly then, the European public sees Donald Trump as the enemy of Europe. And European politicians are very anxious and worried that the Trump administration might betray Ukraine in the peace negotiation with Russia. Thank you, Mr. Dashen, for your insightful analysis.
Thank you very much.
For more on these and other critical issues, be sure to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en. And that brings us to the end of today's program. Join us again next time for another edition of That Was the Week That Was. Take care and goodbye.
Good morning to you all. Greetings from Tehran. You are listening to Iran Radio. I am Asma, your presenter for the next hour. We start off this hour's program with The Keys of Life. The program aims to introduce an Islamic lifestyle based on the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Jabudi Amoli. After that, we have Economic Divide. If you're interested in economic or business issues, then this program is for you. The program covers the biggest business and economic stories of the day. And our